Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Tonight, during PTSD Awareness Month, Stanford psychiatrist and trauma specialist Dr. Shelley Jane joins me to discuss post-traumatic stress disorder and her debut book, The Unspeakable Mind, Stories of Trauma and Healing from the Frontiers of PTSD Science. Although at least 6 million Americans are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder today, PTSD remains a commonly misunderstood condition with potentially devastating effects on the trauma survivors and their communities. In her book, Dr. Jane outlines the causes and risk factors for developing PTSD, as well as its associated mental and physical health consequences. She discusses the complex relationship between our genetics, biology, and environment, and documents the impacts of trauma on our quality of life and society as a whole. Fortunately, a growing body of scientific research is bringing new and effective treatments that provide hope and healing. So we're glad to have Dr. Shelley Jane, Stanford psychiatrist and PTSD specialist who currently serves as the medical director for the integrated care at the Palo Alto VA healthcare system. And she's also affiliated with the National Center for Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder, an organization widely regarded as the world's leading center of excellence on PTSD. Welcome, Dr. Shelley Jane, to City Visions.
Thanks so much for having me. It's my pleasure.
And of course, we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation. We'll open our phone lines in about 20 minutes. That phone number is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. We look forward to your questions and comments on this topic. So I wanted to start with the title of the book. Why did you call this book about PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder? Why is it titled Unspeakable Mind?
So oftentimes when people go through major traumas, it really cuts to the heart of what they believe, how they view life. It really can shake them, and these traumas literally become unspeakable. The truth is too terrible to utter aloud. And sometimes the survivor wants to speak up, but the wider society might not be willing to hear. And so for that reason, the trauma remains unspeakable. The problem is PTSD thrives when the trauma remains unspeakable. The traumatic memories, the unthinkable thoughts, they become these stuck points that interfere with the reintegration that is necessary for healing to occur.
So it sounds like there's some things about people not maybe wanting to hear the person talk about their trauma, and then perhaps that people don't want to speak about it because it's just too hard to remember?
Just too hard to talk about. I mean, integral to trauma is this natural inclination to deny its existence, you know, forget about it, don't even think about it, move forward. Like, these are commonly used terms in our culture and society. We avoid thinking about trauma because it hurts, it's painful. So the natural inclination is to sometimes bury these events, deny them their existence as a way of trying to cope and move on. Unfortunately, the vast majority of time that doesn't work. You know, at some point you have to deal with the trauma. And sometimes it might not even be you. It might be your children or your children's children. Like, someone has to deal with the consequences of the trauma. From my point of view, that's eventually what ends up happening.
Because it sounds like even if it's not spoken, doesn't mean it's not there. It didn't
exactly
happen.
It's exerting its influence, yeah.
In some way, shape, or form,
yes.
Regardless of
yes.
our denial.
Yes,
right?
Exactly.
So that actually, the idea of, you know, how a society might shape someone's experience of a traumatic event makes me ask you about how does our culture kind of shape PTSD? Because it sounds like there's something about how our environment and the platform people have to be able to talk openly about trauma that or not can really affect people's ability to heal from something traumatic that's happened to them. Tell us more about that.
So there's so many social dimensions to PTSD. Like I said, you know, survivors, they if they want to tell their story, they need to be heard. They need to know they're not going to experience secondary injuries or victim blaming. And the nature of PTSD is that it's kind of dipped in and out of our social consciousness throughout the centuries. It feels like every time there's a war, there's more interest in PTSD. Then the war ends and the interest wanes. So there is this collective amnesia that can result around trauma. There is this collective denial that can result. I think we're living in better times. I think we're able to hear voices that previously would not have been heard or would have been silenced or would have been ignored. And I definitely think now we're in a digital age. Voices are appearing that maybe, you know, would have gone unheard. But still, there is this push and pull between society and the individual. Because the thing is, to accept that someone's been traumatized or victimized, we have to also accept that there was a perpetrator a lot of the times. And that instantly puts you in an uncomfortable position as the bystander, as the witness. And so therein begins the story to try and kind of deny it. But it shapes our society too.
So follow-up question to that. Why are we more open to hearing these stories right now? Is it because somehow there's been a shift in our cultural understanding and moral understanding of what trauma is and who's to blame, so to speak? Mm-hmm. Or is it something else that because of the internet and the platforms that exist for people to put their stories out there, mm-hmm. that we just can't turn a blind eye, mm-hmm. or a deaf ear to it because it's just out there?
So since 9/11, since the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, since major natural disasters like Hurricane Katrina, you know, they all were kind of clustered in the first few years of the 21st century, definitely there was a lot more acceptance of PTSD, especially in the aftermath of 9/11. And then the silver line to that cloud, from my perspective as a trauma scientist, is because the powers that be accepted that PTSD was a thing, then there was money to research it. And literally what's happened in the last 20 years, which is unprecedented, is this massive growth in the science of PTSD, dramatic advances. And this is a body of evidence that continues to grow exponentially. So I feel like we've hit that tipping point now where there is just so much science for PTSD that it's getting harder and harder and harder to ignore it, because we just know so much more about it. So it's literally knowledge that I think is the main thrust of what's making it more acceptable and more transparent in our society. And then all those other things too, that I think with the digital revolution, and then, you know, populations that were previously marginalized or had to stay quiet and now have more of a platform. So it's a combination of a lot of things, but definitely the advances in science, I think, has been huge.
So let's turn to that science. First, we sort of dove into a discussion without actually defining PTSD, but mm-hmm. let's do that now. Mm-hmm. Define it for us, and perhaps how has the definition changed, especially, if at all, with the science that has come to bear in the last couple of decades?
I mean, in essence, it's very similar to what it was. I think all that's different is now that we know PTSD is its own entity. It used to be described as an anxiety disorder, but we now know it's got its own imprint and it's seen as a traumatic stress-related disorder. Typically, what is involved is someone has survived a major trauma, and by major trauma, typically that means a life-threatening event where you were rendered helpless, utterly horrified, where your whole sense of normalcy was shattered. So something like, you know, rape or combat or surviving a natural disaster or, you know, escaping a deadly car accident. Those are just some examples, you know, of the type of traumas that lead to PTSD. And then in the aftermath of a human being exposed to that trauma, you know, they don't get better by themselves. You know, of course, anybody who's exposed to that type of trauma is going to feel distressed in the immediate aftermath. But the reality is a vast majority of people, they get better by themselves with the passage of time. When you develop PTSD, that doesn't happen. And so a month later, 2 months later, 3 months later, you're still having things like intrusive memories of that trauma, nightmares of the trauma, flashbacks where you feel like you're reliving the trauma in the present. Those are some of the kind of textbook, you know, classic features of PTSD. What a lot of people don't know is how PTSD renders an emotional life barren. You know, people can literally live on the verge of alienation from the world and those who love them. It can really mute happiness and impact the way people love and create and work. So that's the insidious way that it shapes lives.
That sounds pretty pervasive. And you talked about individuals and experiences that they have that are life-threatening or just sort of disrupt their sense of any being able to control their lives or their circumstances. Is there a concept of PTSD writ large in terms of on a societal level, a community that's witnessed a lot of violence, mm-hmm. Perhaps in war or other scenarios? And how does that, the same or different when it's something that's experienced by a large number of people, whether it's directly to them or they've seen it happening to other people but have been in close proximity to it?
Mm-hmm. So So say, for example, take the United States. We know that there's some populations who are at higher risk for developing PTSD. So, you know, military would be your first obvious one because of the occupational exposures that they have. First responders is another group of people. Low-income women, another group of people. And then youth who are raised in high crime inner city areas. So these are communities where trauma is a fact of life. They all have higher rates of PTSD than the general population. And then if you want to look globally, the last 20 years, we've had this wealth of science where scientists have actually gone into war-torn communities and they've documented rates of PTSD in civilian survivors of war and in refugees. And we know the rates are really high. You know, a good chunk of people who survive mass traumatization will develop PTSD, and it won't go away by itself. And we don't pay enough attention to the psychological rehabilitation of these communities that are traumatized en masse. Mm.
And so you mentioned the military, that there's a pretty direct connection there. What is it about the lives of people who are low-income, especially women, as you mentioned, and youth, that puts them at greater risk? Is it that they're just the chance of them having a traumatic event in their life is greater, or is there something else that affects the development of PTSD?
So I think as far as low-income youth who are being raised in high-crime inner-city areas, that's just a simple matter of dose, exposure to trauma. They're just going to be much more exposed to death and trauma, whether it be family violence or street violence, and then that just ratchets up your chance of developing PTSD at some point. With the women, it's kind of interesting because even though women theoretically are less likely to be exposed to trauma than men, women are 2 to 3 times more likely to develop PTSD. And part of that may be hormonal differences, but for me, the major reason that makes sense is the types of trauma that women are exposed to. So, for example, women are much more likely to be victims of rape. Women are much more likely to be victims of intimate partner violence. And there's something about those type of traumas which is potently traumatizing. And a lot of it, I think, has to do with the stigma that shrouds those traumas. So, for example, you know, before the Me Too movement, and even to this day, despite the Me Too movement, a lot of times when women who had survived sexual assault would speak up, they would face secondary injuries, or they would be stigmatized, or they would be blamed. And there's something about the way women are either socialized or wired when we're being denied this social support after trauma. It's really rough. It's very hard. Women can do really well as long as they have the support they need, no matter what they've been through. But when that support is denied, there's something about that is really hard.
So what are other risk factors? You mentioned that and I don't know, do you have a percentage of people who experience a traumatic event who do fine, and then there's the subset? What percentage of people who experience a traumatic event go on to develop PTSD, and what are the characteristics that bring that about?
So the actual percentage, it's relatively small. It's like 8 to 10%. Okay, which is a small percentage. But the problem is you've got to look at the rates of trauma exposure in the first place. They're so high. Like 60% of American men, 50% of American women will survive a major trauma in their lifetime. So the numbers are so high that even a small percentage translates to a lot of people. And like you were saying, 6 million people at any given moment in time have symptoms of PTSD that need treatment.
Just in the United States.
That's just in the United States. And that's not to say it doesn't happen abroad. We're just much better at documenting it. But the rates abroad aren't that different. Mm-hmm. Probably even higher. So who develops? That's the million-dollar question. A third of it is probably down to genetics, believe it or not. It's down to how you are wired. It's down to how your body mounts a response to stress. So a lot of it is determined by genetics. So in a way, even though PTSD is linked to this external trauma, it's actually a highly heritable condition. And that's something we've only realized in the last 20 years or so.
And definitely want to talk more about that intergenerational trauma and talk about how that and genetics kind of overlap. What else renders one vulnerable besides genetics?
Yeah, so gender we touched on. Women are more vulnerable for the reasons that I outlined earlier. you know, having a family history of psychiatric issues, being from a socioeconomically disadvantaged background. And I think that has a lot to do with your sense of agency, you know, how sympathetic a victim you are, you know, how much attention you can get, you know, how much of your wounds can be healed through the societal support. So those are some of the things that come to mind. There are probably many factors, but I think, you know, between genetics, gender, and a previous history of mental illness, those probably account for a big chunk of determining who develops PTSD and who won't.
And what's the time course of the developing PTSD? Is it, you know, if you made it through the first 6 to 12 months after the traumatic event that you're free and clear, or is there a chance that it just could pop up at any time afterwards?
Yeah, so it's a bit complicated. I mean, the kind of textbook thing is that if you're having symptoms for longer than a month, you may possibly have PTSD. Obviously, you have to see a healthcare professional to get diagnosed, but that's about the mark that we look at, the 4 weeks. But it is complicated because sometimes people literally can experience a trauma and somehow compartmentalize it. And it can stay that way for years, and then it kind of can rear its head, you know, many years later. But for the most part, the trajectory is like that, that after a month, if they're still having symptoms and it's not getting better and their life is very disrupted, then you start to think about PTSD.
Well that speaks to part of the discussion in your book about memories and how memories are coded in our brain and different types of memories, and how perhaps people who may have denied that something happened or may suddenly understand it or experience it differently many, many years later, which I imagine is also adds to a lot of the potential secondary victimization of someone saying, well, why are you remembering this now,
yes,
some
yes,
30 years later, right?
Yes.
But let's bring it to the memory thing. Tell us about how PTSD interacts with our memory system.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of scientists call PTSD, it's actually a disorder of memory. That's what we like to think of it now. And certainly it's helpful for me to think about it that way, because the paradox about memory and PTSD actually cuts to the heart of a lot of the controversies, like you just said. So, you know, we know the hippocampus. There's something up with the hippocampus in the brains of people who have PTSD.
What's the hippocampus?
So it's a part of the brain in the temporal lobe where long-term memories are stored. And it's smaller in people who have PTSD. We don't know why. We don't know if they were just born with a smaller hippocampus or if after exposure to trauma, the hippocampus shrunk. But so there's something up with the hippocampus. And in essence, in PTSD, there's two types of memories. There's the involuntary memories. So you're not summoning up these memories. They are coming to you, whether you like it or not. And they're invading your day. And they're very intrusive. And they're memories associated with the trauma, you know, invade your life for weeks, days, months, years after the traumatic event, and thoroughly disruptive. And then there's the voluntarily recalled trauma narrative, which is, you know, the way someone might tell you, oh, when I was 17, I was involved in a major car accident. But the voluntarily recalled trauma narrative can sometimes really lack emotion. People can be really vague and disorientated when they're talking about it. And that is just because of the nature of traumatic memories, that sometimes people can just not fully comprehend what is going on when they're experiencing it. So even when they recall it, it can be vague. So you get this instant paradox. You've got these very intrusive, very vivid memories where people are really clear that they're experiencing something that's distressing. But at the same time, you've got this very vague trauma account. So the paradox between the two explains a lot of the controversies. And like you said, sometimes these people cannot have a conscious memory of being traumatized, but yet they can navigate the world as someone who appears to be traumatized. And so sometimes that presents before them actually remembering that they had suffered a trauma. And often that happens when there was severe childhood trauma, because I think at that developmental stage, trauma is processed a little differently.
I see. For example, you know, Christine Blasey Ford was accused of fabricating her allegations against then Supreme Court nominee and now Justice Brett Kavanaugh because she couldn't remember some specific details of the assault, and yet she remembered some other details really well. I think it was she could remember what she was wearing, the music that was playing, some other specific details, but then she couldn't remember how she got home that night, for example. How do you explain that?
But that there you go. That's that instant paradox. So that's how someone can stand up literally and tell you, I know this happened to me. They know it, but yet they can't quite remember the details because at the time that it happened, the way trauma memories are laid down, there are these kind of defects in the trauma. So this paradox, again, you see this in a lot of survivors of trauma, this kind of chaotic, strange story. It's fragmented. It doesn't seem cohesive. That's just the nature of traumatic memories. Mm. And I think we have to be a bit more mindful of that, you know, because if we start going into inquisition mode every time something doesn't add up logically, people shut down. They don't want to talk about it anymore because it's kind of being turned on them. But I think it's worthwhile just recognizing that is the nature of trauma narratives.
And are these two different types of memories you're talking about, are they stored in different parts of the brain?
You know, I don't think we have a full sense of where they're stored. We know that one of them is triggered by environmental cues and it's like an implicit memory.
Those are the intrusive ones.
Yes, the involuntary ones. And the other ones are deliberately recalled. You know, it's the same way how you'd recall your phone number or your date of birth. You actually go into your memory bank to recall it. So the method of retrieval is different. Okay. I'm not quite sure where they would be stored or if we know that information.
Okay. And the triggers can be pretty subtle and something that people wouldn't even be able to understand or link to to the traumatic event, right?
Right. That's what's so strange. The cues could be everywhere in the environment. It could be a certain smell. It could be a certain sound. It could be shifting weather patterns, you know, associated with the trauma. It could be so many things that we are repeatedly exposed to in our environment. But oftentimes, trauma survivors, they can't independently connect the dots. Oftentimes, people need the help of a mental health professional to be able to connect the dots between their triggers and their trauma experiences.
In case you're just joining us, this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. And I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we are talking about post-traumatic stress disorder. This is PTSD Awareness Month with Dr. Shelley Jane, Stanford psychiatrist, PTSD specialist, and author of the book The Unspeakable Mind, Stories of Trauma and Healing from the Front Lines of PTSD Science. We invite you, our listeners, to call in with your questions and comments. The number to dial to join our conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can email or text us now at cityvisions@kalw.org. Tweet us or post a comment on our Facebook page. Do you suffer from PTSD or do you know someone who does? What treatments have you or someone you know sought and how's that helped them? Tell us about how you feel about PTSD in our society and what our society's responsibility is to support people who've survived trauma. 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. So I want to go back to you for a moment. You finished your training in psychiatry and initially went into private practice. And then you write about a road trip that you took with your father in this book. Tell us about that road trip and how it changed the course of your career.
So in 2007, I took a road trip with my parents. They were visiting from England. That was where I was born and raised. And my dad had just turned 70, so we took this road trip up the East Coast to celebrate his 70th birthday. And then on the way back, as we were heading back to the Midwest, because that's where I was practicing at the time, he started telling me this story about what happened to him in 1947. He started talking about his parents, brothers and sisters, people who I'd never really known, and his upbringing in India in 1947. And, you know, in essence...
And that year is significant because?
So in 1947, the British got ready to quit India after a few hundred years of colonial rule. And before they quit, they divided the country into two, India with the Hindu majority and then Pakistan with the Muslim majority. But unfortunately, their plan was very kind of negligently orchestrated, very haphazardly executed, and the result was horrific intercommunal violence. So this was a really bloody chapter in the history of the South Asian subcontinent. And, you know, my paternal grandfather was murdered in the violence that ensued. And I'd always known that, but there was something about the way my dad narrated the story this time around, which was kind of fascinating to me. By this time, I was a psychiatrist. And he was older, you know, he just turned 70 and he'd been going back to India a lot more and he'd been collecting details from family members and putting together this story. And by this point in time, he was the sole surviving member of his family of origin. And I think I finally recognized what he was trying to tell me. He was offering me testimony, you know, and there was something about that testimony that very intentional narration. You know, it's beyond the casual. That really, in a way, forced me to decide, okay, well, what am I going to do with the rest of my career? I have this voice. I have this platform. It turns out that I am from people who suffered massive trauma. I was kind of disconnected from it because I grew up in England. But those were really my people. When I heard the whole story, it was very apparent to me. I'm from a very traumatized family. And so thus began this desire to kind of specialize in PTSD and study PTSD and advance the science of PTSD.
And may I ask, did your father have PTSD in your mind, do you think?
So my dad, my dad is really interesting in that, you know, he's 82 and he's a survivor. And if anything else, I think what I've learned from him, because I think writing the book forced me to kind of confront some of those issues. But I think the only conclusion that I come to is the one thing he did that was very beneficial is he did the opposite of what most trauma survivors do. He spoke of it. He never denied it. He never allowed it to be unspeakable. And when I was younger, the way he would speak about the trauma was very kind of clumsy. It was very chaotic, kind of like what we were talking about before, very difficult to listen to, kind of nonsensical. But I think his whole life, he was trying to make sense of that trauma. And the fact that he kind of kept it alive and didn't deny it and didn't avoid it, I think that led to him, you know, being able to overcome it in a way, and be able to have resilience, despite the fact, you know, he lost almost everything in 1947.
Mm-hmm. So he's trying to kind of knit the story together in
yes,
a way that
and
he
makes sense of it, makes sense meaning of it,
and perhaps sort of distance himself from it.
No, I think just make meaning of it and understand it and make his peace with it. Making meaning is a thing that trauma survivors do a lot. Like the trauma survivors who are able to be resilient in the face of trauma and go on to transcend the trauma, a lot of what they do is make meaning. So channeling their energies into something that they believe in or that they're passionate about, that is their way of kind of making meaning out of the trauma. Do you see what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. like this bad thing happened, but this is what I did with it. You know, so for him, it was education. You know, that was his big thing, making sure I was educated, even though it wasn't, you know, a fashionable thing for a man to do of that generation, to educate a daughter. But being very, you know, clear about that and the importance of that. So channeling his energies in a way that he felt would be befitting of that story, you know, and that would honor his parents and kind of restore his family name to what it once was.
So you've talked earlier on about that traumatic stress not only impacts the survivors, but it can also be passed down to their family members. And, mm-hmm. and you made mention of how you think that, you know, PTSD or the propensity for it is, more precisely, is... Mm-hmm. Can be heritable, mm-hmm. and that it's genetic. So tell us a little bit more about this generational trauma and how it gets passed down. Is it something that happens on a genetic level? Is it something about the environment that someone grows up in, mm-hmm. exposed to the experiences of their elders? A little bit of both, something mm-hmm. else?
So there's definitely that piece. That piece we've known for a while, that obviously if you're raised by someone who has PTSD, that's going to impact the way you navigate the world, and you know that's going to rub off in some way or another. So this kind of social, emotional learning and that environment, that we've known of for decades, and that is a thing. You know, if you are raised by someone who has PTSD, the odds of you having PTSD or depression or anxiety goes up. So there's definitely something about trauma that is infectious. The other piece, the epigenetics piece, still in our infancy of understanding, you know, I'm not sure it's fully ready for prime time, but there's been enough advances in the last 10 years or so that it's safe to say that if a man is exposed to a major trauma or a woman is exposed to a major trauma, it can impact negatively the man's sperm, the woman's eggs, and it's possible that those negative changes can then be passed down to subsequent children via this process.
At the level of the DNA,
yes,
you mean,
there you
specifically?
Go. Yes, on a cellular level. So that their children inherit these kind of vulnerabilities, you know, altered neurochemistry or altered neurobiology, even though the children themselves may never be exposed to trauma. But in the event they are in their life, which we've already discussed is probably a common thing, then they're going to respond with that history. You know, those kind of historical changes and the cellular changes, they're going to respond to that trauma with with that altered, with those altered cellular changes. So in my mind, you know, when we think of mass traumatization, if you think of like torture, slavery, genocide, mass traumatization, that's where I find the epigenetics really fascinating. Because if you think if that really is happening, then you get a sense of the deep footprint of PTSD, how it can literally span generations.
Is there something about that someone who's experienced traumatic events and develops PTSD is then somehow more likely to experience other traumatic events? I'm just trying to think of the environment that, that sort of like from the genetic standpoint, from the sort of the way people make sense of the world and how they pass that down to their children, and then perhaps whether there's just more likelihood for more trauma in the milieu. Does that make any sense to you?
So I think definitely if we look at, well, socioeconomics is a big part of it, right? Because I feel like your zip code is going to determine a lot of your trauma exposure, you know? So I think that's one dimension of it, that why someone who has PTSD might be exposed to repeated traumas, but that's almost external factors. Then there is this phenomenon of kind of reenactment where, you know, if that's all you've ever known, you know, growing up, say, in family violence or in violent relationships, if that's all you ever really know, even though it causes you so much distress and trauma, it might be that on some level, that is what you're seeking out, you know, either by being re-victimized or becoming the aggressor and reenacting the trauma. So there is something about that kind of carrying that sense of trauma and the re-traumatization and it following you through in your life. And again, I think that's what happens when people are not understanding the trauma and the toll it takes on your life. So again, early intervention and elevating our public dialogue about trauma, I think that's the only way to overcome situations like that.
This is City Visions on 91.7 local public radio, KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing post-traumatic stress disorder with Dr. Shaylee Jain, Stanford psychologist, PTSD specialist, and author of the book The Unspeakable Mind, Stories of Trauma and Healing from the Front Lines of PTSD Science. The phone lines are open if you'd like to join us. 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. You can also email or text us now at cityvisions@KALW. Tweet us or post a comment on our Facebook page. We actually had a caller who did not wish to speak on the air. Carla from Oakland says that she's had a treatment in the past for PTSD called EMDR and was surprised by the effectiveness of the technique. The first time she experienced something other than just talk therapy, and over time her level of what she calls arousal, and perhaps you can explain these symptoms in more detail. She says it here is, in fact, meaning tears, anxiety, etc., diminished. Would like to know the mechanism by which EMDR works.
So that's a great question. You know, the best treatment we have for what works for PTSD, you know, the treatments that have been shown to be effective are trauma-focused psychotherapies, of which EMDR is one. There's others like prolonged exposure, cognitive processing therapy. And we don't really have the dismantling studies to know exactly what the secret sauce ingredients are, but there's probably a few things that we can be sure of that work. First of all is the exposure element. So a lot of people who go through trauma-focused psychotherapy, a lot of it involves really deconstructing the trauma, re-exposing the patient, whether it be in the clinic room or by doing exercises outside of the exam room, to reminders of the trauma and literally re-exposing your body to the extent that your body is no longer hijacked by those triggers.
Is this similar to like exposure therapy, let's say if someone's afraid of flying?
Similar, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is similar to that. And that the arousal that the caller's talking about is that these symptoms of PTSD, you know, that basically in PTSD, the fight or flight response just doesn't switch off. So people are just quick to startle, quick to see danger everywhere. Blood pressures run high, pulses rate high. And so they're kind of always on edge. So re-exposure to the triggers, to the point where your body gets a little bit desensitized. You know, you're probably never going to be comfortable with the triggers, but at least so that you're back in control is a key part of how these treatments work. The other thing these treatments do is just basic psychoeducation about trauma, breathing, retraining, relaxation skills. Those can be immensely helpful. And then also the cognitive restructuring. A lot of people who have survived trauma, they carry a lot of burden because they develop a lot of maladaptive beliefs around the trauma. And those almost make the PTSD worse. So, for example, a lot of people will blame themselves when there's a traumatic event, when really, if you break it down as an objective person, they didn't have that much control over what was going to happen. But the fact that they blame themselves or they feel guilty about it reinforces the trauma. So deconstructing those thoughts is a big part of the treatment.
Or feeling perhaps, why can't I control all these intrusive memories? Do people ever say, I wish I should be stronger, I should be able to take care of this?
Oh, sure. There's a lot of like internalized stigma, right? Like why is this such a big deal? Or, you know, certainly in the military population that I see, a lot of returning veterans, they're like, I survived. I came home. What business do I have feeling anything other than, you know, gratitude when I lost so many comrades or buddies? So a lot of this starts to seep into their internal thought process, and you can kind of see how that it's very burdensome to live with all of that.
So it's not just the details of the event, which are very fragmented, but the story one tells oneself.
Exactly. That narration you tell yourself that can be really, people can be really hard on themselves.
Let's go to Ariana from San Francisco. Ariana, welcome to City Visions.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I'm a clinical psychologist. I just want to make a couple points quickly. First of all, that trauma stores a lot of energy, and that energy is going to be released often in other traumatic events. And so it's not just something that ends easily after a certain healing time. And so when we beget wars anywhere in the world, those traumatic events do not end with our leaving or supposedly saying that we've finished whatever our goals were, fighting those wars. And as such, I think that it's really important at some point that the United Nations declare war a criminal event and that the instigators of war be held responsible.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your comment. What do you make of Ariana's comments?
So I think from my perspective, I'm very interested in violence prevention, period, you know, because obviously that's the purest way to prevent trauma. And if you prevent trauma, you prevent PTSD. I think what's tricky from when you look at violence prevention programs now, what is encouraging is that there's a lot more precision in the way we are measuring violence prevention. And I think we're getting a lot better at identifying what are the secret source ingredients of what works in violence prevention. And the good news about that is that can be replicated then on mass scale and can be taken to different communities. But that's what's been missing from previous efforts. So anything that I think prevents violence is a good thing, obviously, as far as PTSD is concerned.
So we'll get more to prevention and hear more about some newer therapies that are promising. I wanted to focus on, so we've talked about what puts people at risk for developing PTSD, and then what is you've talked a lot about the way it wreaks havoc on people's lives. Tell us more about sort of the incidence of mental illness, of mm-hmm. substance use, of physical illness or ailments mm-hmm. because of a history of trauma and PTSD.
So PTSD rarely lives alone. It goes hand in hand with addiction and depression and anxiety. And so there's a big mental health comorbidity with PTSD that I think people have to be aware of. Higher risk of death by suicide if you have PTSD. And then in terms of consequences on the physical body, we know PTSD really seeps beyond the confines of, you know, the mind. It infiltrates cells, organs, bodily systems. It's now considered an independent risk factor for heart disease. It's associated with a higher risk of obesity and stroke and cancer. So, you know, understanding the kind of downstream consequences of untreated PTSD, you know, the havoc that it wreaks on the physical body, you know, that's a piece that often goes missed, that people don't understand.
And is that those physical ailments, the illnesses that you talk about, is that because of that sort of broken stress response that sort of is always in overdrive? Is it response to, like, stress hormones mm-hmm. that seem to cause that?
I mean, that's what the theory is. So definitely the human stress hormone cortisol is somehow implicated. The noradrenaline, the adrenaline that you're talking about with the fight-flight response, you know, when you've got higher levels of noradrenaline, adrenaline circulating in your body all the time, that is not good for blood pressure. That's not good for your pulse. That's not good for your platelet stickiness and things that contribute to how your blood flows through your body. So there's certainly that biological. There is this other dimension that comes under the behavioral. We know people with PTSD are much more likely to smoke or, abusers of substances. They're much less likely to take preventive measures for their health. You know, they're not much less likely to, say, exercise regularly or practice safe sex. And then when their doctors give them advice, they're much less likely to follow through on it. So when the doctor says, take your blood pressure medication, they're less likely to be adherent.
And why is that, do you think?
So I think, in my mind, part of it has to do with the very nature of PTSD. Oftentimes people who have PTSD, especially PTSD related to human-made traumas, they're mistrustful. They don't trust people easily. And especially when there's an authority figure or a power differential, they definitely don't trust people. So in my mind, I think a lot of it has to do with that. So I think earning the trust of the patient and understanding that you probably have to go that extra mile will do a lot for their adherence. But until you do that, that's probably not going to happen.
So that's a little bit about, makes me think a little bit about relationships and people with PTSD. Talk about how, what it's like for a person who has PTSD to enter into a relationship, a trusting or loving relationship with mm-hmm. somebody else, and what it's like to be on the other side of that equation as someone in a relationship with someone with PTSD.
So the mistrust comes in again. I think they're mistrustful of everybody, and I think that probably plays out in the way they navigate their interpersonal relationships and their intimate relationships. We know people who have PTSD are much more likely to be divorced. We know they're much more likely to have issues with emotional intimacy and sexual intimacy in the relationship. So you can kind of get a sense for what it's like for the person who's living with it. For the person who loves them, it's tough because a lot of times the spouse ends up shouldering a lot of extra responsibility in that relationship. You know, if the person's not functioning that well, let's say they're avoidant, let's say they don't want to go out too much, then the spouse ends up doing a disproportionate number of the household tasks to kind of compensate. It puts a lot of burden on the relationship. And so you can kind of see, you know, trauma is infectious. Like I say, if you love someone with PTSD, the odds of you developing psychological problems yourself goes up. Mm. The good news is, though, you know, I don't want to sound negative or anything. The good news is recent advances, we've come up with some really great, like, couples therapies that specifically focus on some of these issues, and they help the couple navigate the traumas together, you know. Rather than reinforcing the symptoms, they help them cope in a way that's healthier. And people with PTSD actually do better when the spouse is involved in the treatment. You know, because I feel like having that kind of buddy who's educated and know what's going on and invested in things going better helps people do better. Mm. So this doesn't have to be the way it is, but this is how it's been for a long time.
You haven't spoken about medications. Mm-hmm. Are there any medications that are helpful for people with PTSD?
So a medication, we think of it more second tier, like I said, really the best gold standard is the talk therapies that we've touched on briefly before. Sometimes people can't access those treatments, or they've tried them and they don't work as well. And then we definitely think of medication. The first line medications then would be things like SSRIs or SNRIs.
Antidepressants, so to speak.
Medications commonly known as antidepressants, but actually they work for a lot of things, PTSD being one of them. So the medication sertraline and the medication paroxetine, they both have FDA indications for the treatment of PTSD. So they're generally pretty safe, very well tolerated medications, really help with those arousal symptoms that we talked about, really can help people with the physiological symptoms and the mood symptoms of PTSD. And then sometimes once someone's been on medication, then they might feel like, oh, okay, maybe I'm ready to try therapy now, you know, because I feel like I can do this now. So definitely it comes in. And certainly from my position as a psychiatrist, that is a big part of what I spend my clinical work doing, just because of, you know, the nature of my particular position. So I see a lot more people who need medication as part of their treatment.
But you're saying that the talk therapies, so to speak, are the gold standard.
Gold standard,
here.
Correct.
We have an email from Leanne that speaks to this. Please describe some of the various treatment modalities and how you decided to use them. But specifically, she asks, what are your thoughts on MDMA, or low-dose psilocybin? Mm-hmm. And say more about, is that an experimental therapy? Mm-hmm. What is the science behind it? What would you say to someone who's seeking relief and thinking of these types of
treatments? So when it comes to the psychedelics and the MDMA, it's definitely, I think, under the category of still experimental, you know, still hasn't been thoroughly tested and vetted. So things like ketamine would come under that category, and medical marijuana would come under that category, specifically when it comes to PTSD. Still experimental, a lot of maybe anecdotal or pilot data, but none of the kind of rigorous controlled studies that we'd like to see before we accept something as a treatment. And certainly in terms of side effect profile, we still haven't gotten that kind of data. So those would probably be pretty low down on my list of what I would recommend. A lot of people, the trauma-focused psychotherapies, obviously the thought of revisiting your trauma can be really daunting for some people, to the point where they don't even want to engage in that. The good news is we do have some other therapies that have been tried and tested for people with PTSD that do not necessarily focus on the trauma. So ACT is one, acceptance and commitment therapy. STARE is another one. They focus more on the day-to-day consequences of living with PTSD. So, you know, if the patient complains that, well, I go from 0 to 100 in 3 seconds, you know, my anger's out of control, or I can't keep a relationship down, or I'm having problems keeping a job, the therapist really focuses on helping the person with the here and now and kind of cope with those symptoms by helping them regulate their emotions better or teaching them tips, coping strategies to get through that. So there are non-trauma-focused options available too.
All right. I'll put the phone number out again. This is City Visions on 91.7 KLW San Francisco and on the web at klw.org. And we're talking with Dr. Shelley Jane about PTSD. And she's the author of a new book, The Unspeakable Mind, Stories of Trauma and Healing from the Frontiers of PTSD Science. The number to dial to join our conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Let's go to Dorothea. Dorothea, welcome to the program.
Hi. So I wanted to let you all know about a system called TRE, TRE. What it is when people go through trauma, they have to often suppress the kind of shaking that one's body would normally go through because of the adrenaline when you're, like, you know, you're fighting a war. And so your body suppresses the trembling, and somehow that becomes frozen in your body and in your mind. So the tray system, it's 7 different exercises that gets people trembling, and it gets them to release some of that suppressed adrenaline that got stuck. It doesn't bring up, I've experienced it, it doesn't bring up a lot of psychological trauma, which I was surprised. I thought that it would. In fact, it was just your body starts trembling, and you don't really control it. It's not scary, at least it wasn't for me, and it's a very interesting technique. And I was told by the teacher that the soldiers in, you know, Iraq were using Trey after they would have an incident where they were experiencing trauma, and that was the only thing that really helped them. They had to keep doing it because they kept being re-exposed to trauma. And so I just want to let you know that the trauma is stored in your musculature, and that's one way of kind of getting it out.
Well, thank you so much for your call.
Okay. Take care.
Have you heard of this therapy?
So there's a lot of interest in So, you know, the treatments that I've talked about so far, they're very cognitive, right? You really get in your head, you think about your thoughts, you think about your emotions, you think about the trauma. obviously doesn't have an appeal to a lot of people. And there's a lot of interest in kind of mind-body treatments that focus more on the physical manifestations of the trauma, including what the caller just mentioned, but also things like acupuncture, massage, yoga, tai chi. So using physical ways to kind of release the trauma from your body. So there's a lot of interest, not as well tried and tested as the therapies that I've talked about in terms of evaluation in clinical studies, but definitely as adjunct treatments. So, you know, an additional tool in your toolbox, if you will, to help with some of the symptoms, you know, something to consider for sure.
We have an email here from Kathy, says she's a 66-year-old woman and recounts some of the traumas that she's experienced from an early age, and talked about, just like a previous listener, how about EMDR therapy has been really helpful, and saying that she's been prescribed 24 psychotropic medications during my life, not one of which have ever worked. She says, not one of the literally 60-plus therapists ever asked me about my childhood. I think psychiatrists are too willing to prescribe medications even when they don't help. Thank you for this show. So perhaps she's saying thank you for sort of refocusing the attention on other therapies besides medications.
Right, yeah, absolutely. So again, like I said, if you want to look at the gold standards, it's a talk therapy.
So before we move on to prevention, what are people trying to do? Are they are they really trying to recreate the narrative or restructure it in some way, or put the pieces together, connect the dots?
Yeah, so I think, you know, I mean, in a kind of nutshell, making the unspeakable speakable is the first part, and a lot of times that involves either narrating it or writing it down, you know, and then reworking it with the therapist, filling in the missing gaps and kind of, like you said, getting to the heart of, okay, well, why did you think that? And separating out the trauma from any kind of thoughts that you might have imposed on it after the fact, you know? Reworking the narrative, giving it cohesion, giving it...
giving it voice?
Yes, exactly. Whereas before, you know, it was just too complicated to put into words.
Okay. So you had talked about earlier, well, we mentioned that it's 6 million Americans specifically that have PTSD. PTSD, I imagine, is a syndrome that's seen around the world, not just something here in America or...
Yeah, well, you would think, but there is a little bit of a controversy, certainly in high income countries, certainly in the Western world. You could probably see something that looks like PTSD in every country, you know, in the Western world. And the prevalence rates are pretty similar. So, you know, if you go to Germany versus England versus America, pretty similar prevalence rates. There is this controversy going on because the World Health Organization did do a bunch of epidemiological studies in low, middle income countries. And for some reason, their PTSD rates were coming back as really, really low. So I think China reported a rate of 0%, and Nigeria and South America were having rates of less than 1%. And that really started this controversy of, you know, what is the purpose of a diagnosis that doesn't have this kind of global relevance. That controversy is still going on. But I think in essence, what it draws attention to is different ways, different cultures manifest trauma.
Right. We're trying to perhaps put a Western definition and try to apply it to a culture that expresses trauma or embodies
it differently.
Way.
And so we're not capturing it in the current way the diagnosis is. But that doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
Right. So you mentioned that the only way to really prevent PTSD is to prevent trauma, which seems like a tall order. And then there's, once a trauma has occurred, is there some sort of period of intervention that could really change the course of someone developing PTSD?
Yeah, so there is this period called the golden hours. Like you said, you know, the trauma's happened, but they haven't developed PTSD. So there is this period in between called the golden hours, which scientists and clinicians are very interested in because it kind of represents an opportunity for medical intervention to reset the pathway toward recovery. So there has been some experimental work done where, we've offered people the human stress hormone cortisol, right, to help their body mount a better cortisol response to the trauma. That is shown to be effective in some studies. Other studies use a modified version of some of the trauma-focused psychotherapies we were talking about, a modified version delivered right there in the ER, you know, after someone has survived a car accident or after someone was physically assaulted. You kind of get in there really early with this early intervention strategy, and that is shown to be effective too. So there are a few things that are being investigated. I don't think anything's ready for prime time. But that's definitely a very intriguing way of preventing PTSD.
And we're talking literally hours here?
Yes, literally. By moving their location. So, like I said, people are being seen in the ER immediately in the aftermath of the traumatic event and offered something.
And our first responders that are there to care for people's emotional and psychological needs, are they being trained in any of this, spotting people who may need this kind of therapy, or is it, or end up being able to offer them? Or is that, as you said, still too early?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what's the hard thing about the golden hours. Like we said before, not everybody who survives a trauma is going to develop PTSD. So where's the algorithm for determining who's high risk and who should get that intervention? So there's a lot of things to be worked out. But the fact that we know that there are some interventions that you can offer people that reduces their subsequent chance of developing PTSD, that's exciting and it's worth exploring more. But in terms of out of all the millions of people who are exposed to trauma, who do we offer it to? That's where the practicalities come in.
And we talked a little bit earlier on, you know, the epigenetics, that's not something that we can modify, but we can modify the environment in which people try to make sense and make meaning of the traumatic event afterwards. What should we as a society be thinking about doing, changing our mindset or our approach that will help to prevent or decrease the suffering of people who've experienced traumatic events?
So I feel like we're on the cusp of becoming this trauma-conscious society. And if we could become a trauma-informed society, that would be a great thing. So being a trauma-informed society, in essence, it means, first of all, let's just recognize that if you're lucky enough not to have survived a trauma yourself, the odds are someone in your community, someone you love, has. So just recognizing it for what it is, that these aren't extraordinary events. These are actually very common events. So recognizing it. And then if you're ever in a position that someone needs to talk about it, or you know something has happened to somebody, not colluding with that natural inclination to deny or avoid, creating spaces where people can talk about it and bearing witness to that story. That is huge too. You know, and finally, recognizing that PTSD, it's a serious psychological condition. If someone has PTSD, they need to see a healthcare professional. So it's not enough. Sometimes I think with mental illness, people think that it's okay, not to get that formal help, but recognizing that someone probably needs a formal evaluation and encouraging them to do that, even though they may be inclined not to do that, but kind of being very insistent about that. I think that can be really helpful.
I imagine how someone retells their story could be potentially traumatizing to them and the person hearing the story. So it's good to do it in the professional's hands, so to speak.
I mean, it depends. I mean, you know, throughout the millennia, people have been listening to people's trauma stories, you know. So I think it can be very cathartic if you have a trusted friend or a loved one who's able to hear you out. And we're probably never going to have enough mental health professionals to listen to all of the stories. So definitely as a society, if we're more empathic and more sensitive, that's going to help. But, you know, when someone's suffering, when you can see those symptoms that we talked about, where it's kind of derailing their day-to-day life, then you probably want to make sure they're seeing a healthcare professional so that they're getting the help they need.
And for someone who wants to know where they can go for help, if they're suffering from PTSD symptoms, what's a resource they can go to?
So there's a lot of great resources that I've listed on my website. It's my self-titled website. If you just Google my name, you'll see it. There's a lot of very carefully collated resources specifically for PTSD.
Well, we'll make sure to put that on our website. So I want to thank you, Dr. Shaylee Jain, Stanford psychiatrist, PTSD specialist, and author of the book, The Unspeakable Mind, Stories of Trauma and Healing from the Front Lines of PTSD Science. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
For a link to this and other City Visions shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at klw.org. Oh, and by the way, you're discussing this growing field of PTSD research at the Palo Alto Jewish Community Center this Wednesday at 7 p.m. So go out and listen. I want to thank our engineer this evening, David LaTulipe, and tonight's show was produced by Kendra Klang. We'll be off next week for the 4th of July holiday. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.